Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you, Brother Joe. I'm going to just recap a couple of points I made last night about the theme of my studies this week. Just to remind you, I'm going to be talking about what happens when we reach the point at which we cease to know God. Not necessarily talking about a situation in which our belief in him has been lost. I'm talking about a life in which God is only superficially present, and belief in him no longer has any impact on the way we live. And I think this can happen in a number of ways. There are two main ways I believe it occurs. The first, and perhaps the most common, is a life in which God has become little more than a comforting idea or a convenient reference point when people ask us what we believe. We can go through all the motions of worship. We put money in the collection and we sing the hymns and we read our Bibles. Some of us exhort from the platform or speak at Bible classes. But then we go home and effectively forget God for a week or until the next time we meet. If someone asks us, are you a Christadelphian? We might say, well, of course I am. I have a menorah in my lounge, I have a Star of David in my dining room, and I have an inspiring quote on the toilet door. I homeschool my children, or if I'm an Australian, I send them to one of our four or five Christadelphian schools. I attend ecclesial functions, and I always wear formal clothes to the memorial meeting, because that's what you do. So that's how you know I'm a Christadelphian. Am I a Christian? Well, of course I am. I am a Christadelphian, and Christadelphians are Christians, as I've just shown you. But what's missing here is any reference to motivation and belief, the most important aspects of the Christian life. We might take them for granted. I think we often do. But what good is that unless we can confirm that they are still active? Because it's very easy to lose sight of them. When this happens, God's presence in our lives has been reduced to little more than a sort of spiritual habit. We've convinced ourselves that the cultural behaviours of our community are evidence of spiritual fruit. And as long as we exhibit those behaviours, then we're in good standing with God. Our faith is no longer defined specifically by what we believe, but merely by the way we are perceived and the way we act. We have become cultural Christians, not faithful believers. We start to do things simply because they've always been done. We start to do them in a certain way because that's the way they've always been done. And our focus shifts from simply being a Christian to maintaining a specific type of Christian institution. We find ourselves referring to this institution as if it is equivalent to the religion that it represents. And before long, too much of our energy is devoted to behaviours and traditions that have very little to do with original Christianity. But because those behaviours and traditions are so tightly bound to our collective identity, we're very reluctant, perhaps even afraid, to let them go. And I think this is how the Jews drifted into certain practices that Jesus would later condemn, even though they appeared to be righteous, or at least believed themselves to be so. So that's one way in which we can lose God. And I suspect that Naomi's family lost God in this way. An alternative is a life in which the reality of God is only ever perceived through our trials. Perhaps we've suffered greatly and we blame God for our suffering. Perhaps we're working hard in the ecclesia, but we don't seem to receive any recognition. Perhaps we conclude that God doesn't care about our efforts to serve him. Perhaps we lose faith in his promises because he never seems to respond. When this happens, we have pushed God out of our lives by placing ourselves at the centre of the universe. We've convinced ourselves that he is required, even obliged, to act in the way that we expect. And when he does not, we reject him, whether consciously or unconsciously. That's another way to lose God. And I certainly believe that Naomi lost God in this way too. So to put it simply, rediscovering God is a process that becomes necessary whenever our relationship with him has broken down. When he no longer seems real to us. He doesn't seem to hear. When we can't hear him. Or when a belief in him doesn't make any tangible difference to our lives. Rediscovering God is difficult not because he is hard to find, but because very often we are completely unaware that we have lost him. The story of Naomi and Ruth is not really about a family who left the household of faith and suffered for it. It's actually about why they left and how one of them was restored. I'm going to take a moment to look at some of the names in Ruth. I'd like to start by reading from Ruth chapter 1. So if you'd like to turn there now. During the time of the judges, there was a famine in the land of Judah. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah went to live as a resident foreigner in the region of Moab, along with his wife and two sons. Now the man's name was Elimelech, his wife was Naomi, and his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were of the clan of Ephrath from Bethlehem in Judah. They entered the region of Moab and settled there. Sometime later, Naomi's husband Elimelech died, so she and her two sons were left alone. So her sons married Moabite women. One was named Orpah, and the other Ruth. And they continued to live there about 10 years. Now, I'm not really one for getting too involved with biblical names, because very often we can be a bit disappointed. We can get carried away with the idea that every biblical name is desperately significant, and if we can only find out what the definition of the name is, that will contribute somehow to the point we're making or the theme of our exhortation or Bible class or whatever. Sometimes Bible names can surprise you in the most disappointing way. You focus on a character and you think this is going to be really great, and all you need to do to cap off this brilliant exhortation you're doing is to work out his name and to determine that it fits in with what you want to say. So you look up his name and it turns out to be something banal, like a man who lives under a banana tree. And you think, well, that's not very helpful. I can't use that in a talk. People will laugh. And you realise, of course, well, you know, maybe I should have researched this a little more thoroughly and stayed away from silly assumptions like that. So it's easy to get carried away with Bible names and convince ourselves that their meaning is always significant, or at least somehow relevant to the point we're trying to prove. So I try to avoid drawing lessons from names unless their meaning is very explicit and the connection is very obvious. In the book of Ruth, Naomi herself confirms that names are important to this story. So I think it's worth checking to see what they can tell us. The head of Naomi's family was called Elimelech. His name means God is King. That was very ironic for the time in which they lived, the time of the judges, when there was no king and every man did that which was right in his own eyes. It's an aspirational name, but it didn't fit the times. And it certainly doesn't seem to have fitted the way Elimelech behaved, as we'll see in a moment. The fate of Elimelech's family, in some ways, echoes the fate of the Jewish nation. They were both damaged by a failure of leadership. I think perhaps decades of peace and prosperity had bred complacency and apathy, just as they will in an ecclesia. As Israel's leaders fell one by one into a spiritual sleep, their pastoral role was neglected, and the people's faith diminished. But because the outward signs of religion were still present, nobody realized until it was too late. Judges did their best to restore the nation, but their influence could only be limited and short-lived. So with this in mind, it's not difficult to understand why Elimelech chose to fend for himself when famine struck the land. He wasn't interested in the lifestyle of Moab. If he had been, he wouldn't have waited for a famine before moving. We might say, well, why did he go? Was it because he lacked faith in God? I think that's absolutely true. But it seems to me that he also doubted the willingness or the ability of his own community to support him. And I think that's a lesson for us all by itself. Is our community a place where other people are confident of finding support? Why do people drift to the fringes? Why do people find themselves in a sort of halfway house where they still believe in God, but they can't commit to the community of God? Perhaps they've been damaged by that community, or perhaps they've been misunderstood, or perhaps they receive the impression that nobody really cares. Elimelech knew he was taking a risk, but he thought he had the situation under control, as we so often do before doing something utterly disastrous. And he planned to return when life was more stable. And we know this because he didn't sell his land when he left Israel, even though there was no king or judge to stop him from doing so. And later in the story, that land becomes a lifeline for his widow. The sons of Elimelech were called Mahlon and Chilion, and their names mean sickness and failing. I don't know who thought that was a good idea, because it didn't turn out very well. They die without even reaching the end of Ruth chapter 1. That doesn't necessarily mean they were bad people. Yet they were inconsistent. When their father died, they should have taken their mother straight back to Israel. But they didn't. They wanted to find wives before they did anything else, and they were happy to do this in Moab. And let's take a look at those wives. Come to Ruth chapter 1, verse 8. Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Listen to me. Each of you should return to your mother's home. May the Lord show you the same kind of devotion that you have shown to your deceased husbands and to me. May the Lord enable each of you to find security in the home of a new husband." Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept loudly. But they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." Orpah and Ruth were, I think, good people. And we know this from the way they treat Naomi and from the respect that Naomi gives to them. But they were not Jews. They were not even proselyte Jews. Naomi still refers to your people and your gods when addressing Ruth. Ruth still refers to your people and your God when addressing Naomi. They knew they were different in fundamental, incompatible ways. Mahlon and Chilion didn't seem to have been concerned by this. They had acclimatized themselves to their new environment. First, they developed tolerance. Tolerance gave way to acceptance. Moab was a comfortable place to live, and they fitted in reasonably well after a time. They were no longer separate, as they should have been. People knew, of course, that these people, these Jews from outside, worshipped a different god. But we don't know what this actually involved in practical terms. And it doesn't seem to have distinguished them greatly from the Moabites. There's no doubt that following the death of their father, Elimelech's sons would have felt grief, possibly anger, frustration, helplessness, and depression. Perhaps they met Orpah and Ruth during this grieving process. Perhaps they found comfort and support from their wives. But at some point, their faith, their distinctiveness was eroded, and with it, their desire to return to Israel. Losing a parent can change you in fundamental ways. I lost my father when I was 16 years old. He committed suicide. That certainly changed me in a very deep way, and it made me a different person. But the key to a situation like that is to be determined that this event will not define you. To move on. To find strength in your community, in your relationship with God, in your relationship with your friends, in your relationship with your family. Incidents like this must not be allowed to define who we are. Because when this happens, we will be permanently locked in the past. Malan and Killian didn't really get past that. They were defined by these tragic events. And at some point, it destroyed their faith. It left them unwilling to return to Israel. Maybe there was shame. Maybe there was guilt. For whatever reason, they couldn't do it. And there's a very simple lesson behind all of this, and it's one that the Bible repeats incessantly, but it's still one of those lessons that we always find easiest to forget whenever it suits us. And the lesson is this: if our contact with an unbelieving world becomes so great that our private lives are permanently affected, we will invariably lose something of great value. Perhaps something material. Perhaps something spiritual. In the case of Malan and Killian, it was their lives. They became increasingly aimless after their father had died. They became sporadic. Their behaviour had no clear direction. They had no commitment, no goals for the future. They died because they departed from the way, the truth, and the life. I think to some extent, Malan and Killian remind us of the law of Moses, and not in a negative way. They could teach their wives the basic principles of salvation. Now, it's not clear that they ever did. Nevertheless, even if they had done, they could not carry those principles to a righteous conclusion. They lacked the strength. They lacked the commitment. They lacked the deep relationship with God. And in a similar way, the law of Moses could provide the knowledge necessary for salvation, but it could not ultimately save. Yet we cannot appreciate or take part in the saving work of Christ unless we first understand the law, which contains the principles upon which the new covenant is based. This was certainly true of Ruth. Her first husband was imperfect, offering only the basic knowledge of salvation without the final reward. But her second husband was very different. I think it's appropriate that Ruth is released from the sickness and death which consumed Elimelech's sons. She was granted not only a new lease of life, but a son to call her own. This reminds us of our own situation. We are, in a sense, spiritual widows, having been loosed from an old husband that we might embrace the new. The old husband was the law of Moses. The new husband is Christ, of whom Boaz is a type. When Naomi returns to Israel, she's exhausted and despairing. Her name means my joy, my pleasant one. But now she says, call me Mara, bitter. God has dealt very bitterly with me. And you might remember that Mara was a place in the wilderness where God turned bitter water into sweet water to sustain his people. The story is in Exodus 15, though we won't get there right now. But Naomi reverses this. She effectively accuses God of poisoning her. She has returned in the most humiliating circumstances. Under the culture of the day, her people would have every right to reject her. She's lost her husband. She's lost her sons. She has no heir. All she has to show for her time in Moab is a foreign daughter-in-law from a nation explicitly cursed by the law of Moses. Ruth's name means companion. But who wants companionship with Moab? And yet, the most important fact is that Naomi has returned and that her community restores her in love. And the inspired writer acknowledges this, I believe, by refusing to accept her change of name. He continues to call her Naomi throughout the entire book. He is not willing to accept her pessimistic outlook because in his eyes she has not changed. In God's eyes she has not changed. There is still hope. And this is consistent with the themes of optimism and faith which run throughout the book of Ruth. Eventually, they will overcome Naomi's bitterness. Look at the relief, the happiness, the welcome that Naomi receives in Ruth chapter 2. People are happy to see her. They accept that her history has been a shaky one. She has a checkered past, if you like. But they don't hold that against her. Can our community say the same? Can our ecclesias say the same? Do we have the same compassion for lost sheep that God and Christ both have for us? What do we do when people stray from our community and seek to return? Can we restore them as generously as Naomi's community restored her? It's in Ruth chapter 2 that we read of Naomi's kinsman, Boaz. And his name means, in it is strength. I think that's quite appropriate given his role in the story. And we find an allusion to this in 2 Chronicles chapter 3, if you want to turn there with me now. 2 Chronicles chapter 3, verse 13. I'm sorry, that's 2 Chronicles chapter 3, verse 17. And here the record is speaking of the building of Solomon's temple. And it tells us that Solomon set up the pillars in front of the temple, one on the right side and the other on the left. He named the one on the right Jachin, which means he establishes. And the one on the left he called Boaz, in strength. Taken together, he establishes in strength. I think that's a wonderfully appropriate allusion to the name of Boaz and his work in the life of Naomi and Ruth. Boaz was, quite literally, a pillar of his local community. He lived by faith and he led by example. He commands his young men to treat Ruth with dignity and respect, even though she's a Moabitess. He obeys the law of Moses, and he does not round the corners of his field. but he deliberately leaves them for the poor to glean. He even tells his reapers to leave extra corn on the ground, far beyond the requirements of the law. He acknowledges that Ruth has made a commitment to God in her own basic way, and he commends her for this decision. So Boaz is rich, but he's also generous. When the famine struck Israel, he chose to remain instead of escaping the hardship that it brought. We might say, well, Boaz could do this because he was a rich man and he knew the famine would not affect him. But that's not necessarily the case, because Abraham had also been a wealthy man, yet he still moved to Egypt to avoid a famine. Boaz might not even have been a wealthy man when Elimelech left Israel all those years ago, well over a decade. He could have still been working his way up in the family business. And of course, being a rich man, he had liabilities, responsibilities. He had people that he needed to care for. He needed to have faith and confidence that he could look after the people who were under his responsibility. Perhaps Boaz finally took over the business from his father or inherited it. But whatever the case, he didn't survive because he was rich. He survived the famine because he was faithful. He was willing to provide assistance to the poor. He shared his wealth for the benefit of those around him. He doesn't even leave the work to everybody else. He actually gets involved in it. He's constantly involved in ecclesial life. And he works alongside his servants. And he never asks them to do anything that he wouldn't do himself. He knows them personally, and they know their master's voice. Instead of returning to a comfortable bed at night, he sleeps in the threshing floor because he wants to get straight back into the job as soon as he awakes. And he reminds others of their collective responsibility towards their brothers and sisters. Naomi's desperation is clearly seen in the risk that she took by sending Ruth to Boaz. He could have rejected her and accused Naomi of attempting to damage his reputation for personal advantage. Or he could have seduced Ruth and used his influence in the community to keep the matter quiet. He could have destroyed Naomi's reputation completely. But he did none of these things. And there's something in the way that Boaz responds to Ruth which suggests he's an older, more mature man. Perhaps he realized that Ruth would only have come to him at Naomi's request. Perhaps he appreciated the significance of sending her at night when her physical beauty could not be seen and only her character was on display. Look at the reply of Boaz to Ruth in chapter 3, verse 10. Boaz says, "May you be rewarded by the Lord, my dear. This act of devotion is greater than what you did before. For you have not sought to marry one of the young men, whether rich or poor. Now, my dear, don't worry. I intend to do for you everything that you propose. For everyone in the village knows that you are a worthy woman." The translation that I'm using, the NET Bible, says that Boaz refers to Ruth as "my dear." The Hebrew actually says "my daughter." It's another suggestion that Boaz is significantly older than Ruth. But it immediately shows that he cares for her. He's willing to take responsibility for and be identified with her. He gives full credit to the purity of Ruth's motives and the care she has shown for Naomi. This is good evidence that Boaz realizes Naomi is appealing to him through Ruth, which helps to explain why he trusted her so quickly. I think there's a certain unspoken dialogue occurring at the higher level between these two more mature people. And Boaz doesn't send Ruth home empty-handed with nothing but a few vague promises. He sends her home with some grain. Has anyone worked out how much barley Boaz gives Ruth? Boaz sends Ruth home with 27 kilograms of barley. I don't know what that is in pounds, but I'm guessing it's a fair bit. Thank you very much, Bruce. 60 pounds. Now, quite apart from anything else, that's a tribute to the hard-working ethos of Ruth. And I'd say that any woman capable of lugging 27 kilograms of barley home is a dangerous woman to go shopping with, because she will expect her husband to carry at least twice that amount. But it's a message to Naomi. It's a promise of commitment. Boaz is telling Naomi she'll never need to work or beg, because he'll provide for them forever. He'll give them more than they need. And we can almost hear Naomi high-fiving Ruth in chapter 3, verse 18, where she says, "This man will not rest until he has taken care of the matter today." She's absolutely right, because in chapter 4, verse 3, Boaz goes to the men of the village, and he recites the story of Naomi's life to them. "Remember Elimelech," he says. "He's dead now, but he was our brother. And his widow is still with us. What have we done for her? What have we done for our brother's family?" When the nearer kinsman is not willing to redeem Ruth, Boaz takes on the duty himself. And the best part is that he doesn't do it out of duty. He does it out of love. Boaz could sympathize with Ruth's situation. He wasn't a proselyte Jew himself, but his own family contained Gentile roots. Boaz was descended from Rahab the harlot. So it's appropriate that he saves a Gentile woman by adopting her into the household of Israel. So we read all these fantastic things about Boaz, and perhaps we'd say to ourselves, "Well, that's great, and it's impressive, and Boaz is a terrific guy, and I wish I could be like him and do all the things that he did. But obviously I can't, because I'm not rich or influential. I'm not a pillar of my community. I'm lucky to get a chair. And let's face it, modern life is difficult enough without trying to solve everyone else's problems for them." But if we think we can't do what Boaz did, we do ourselves a disservice. Because Boaz didn't do anything that we can do, that we cannot do. In fact, there's a verse in the Bible which lists everything that Boaz did. And I defy anyone to read this verse and say, "I can't do any of that." Come with me to James chapter 1, verse 27. In James chapter 1, verse 27, the apostle says, "Pure and undefiled religion before God the Father is this: to care for orphans and widows in their misfortune, and to keep oneself unstained from the world." That's how easy it is to live a life of faith. That's practical Christianity in a nutshell, right there. That's all we need to sustain and build our community, to convert those who are faithless, to strengthen those who are weak in faith, to produce and nurture faithful young people. Naomi came to realize this when she eventually rediscovered God. And she was inspired to seek him again when she saw how Ruth had responded. She realized that if God is happy to accept a new convert, he'll be overjoyed when one of his lost sheep returns to the fold. Naomi had returned to Israel in anger and bitterness, but she hadn't forgotten her people. She hadn't forgotten that the only place she could find salvation was within the household of faith, through a covenant relationship with the Father. Naomi could not rediscover God in Moab. She could only recognize the need to rediscover him. If we spend our lives in ungodly places, we cannot complain when he's difficult to find. By leaving Moab, Naomi was renewing her commitment to God. By offering her parcel of land as a dowry for Ruth, she was giving up all that she had in order to make her peace with the Father. Where else do we find such an attitude? Come with me to Mark chapter 12, verse 38. In his teaching, Jesus also said, "Watch out for the experts in the law. They like walking around in long robes and elaborate greetings in the marketplace and the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honour at banquets. They devour widows' property, and as a show, they make long prayers. But these men will receive an even more severe punishment." Then he sat down opposite the offering box, and he watched the crowd putting coins into it. Many rich people were throwing in large amounts. And a poor widow came and put in 2 small copper coins worth less than a penny. He called his disciples and said to them, "I tell you the truth, this poor widow has put into the offering box more than all the others. For they all gave out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in what she had to live on, everything she had." The coins that the widow placed into the offering box were called mites. One mite was the 20th part of the Roman penny. And the Greek word for mite is lepton, meaning a leaf. This coin was so small, so light, and so worthless that it might as well have been one. But by giving all that she has to the temple treasury, this woman is giving her life to God. Each mite is a portion of her faith. And whether it be as small as a grain of mustard seed or as lowly as a tiny parcel of land, in God's eyes, its real value is immeasurable. Naomi lost God when her faith was damaged by the loss of her family and her time outside her community. Naomi sought God after realizing that Ruth had found him. Boaz did nothing that we cannot do ourselves. Naomi's community restored her with joy and love. God blessed Naomi with a family to replace the one she had lost. What else do we learn from Naomi's experience? A faithful community converts the faithless, supports the weak, and produces the strong. Is our community a place where God can be found? Rediscovering God is a humbling process. True faith is personal, not merely cultural. God exceeds expectations, and it's never too late to rediscover him.